Hey guys, your old pal Will here, reporting to you from my underground bunker. We're entering a new and hopefully short-lived era of the podcast, the coronavirus era. This is the first piece of content that Luke and I are recording separately through the miracle of modern technology. It's a bit of an awkward time. We're experimenting with different technological ways to get through this period. We recorded this episode through Zoom, and I'll be honest with you folks, sound quality is a little iffy. In particular, I sound like I'm underwater. Apologies for that. To quote the great Ed Wood, our next one will be better. In the meantime, I hope you will be patient with us during this awkward and difficult time. I also hope Michael and Us Nation is keeping its spirits up in a challenging time for everyone. Rest assured, no amount of coronavirus is going to stop that sweet, sweet content from flowing.
So my girlfriend sent me this thing. Obviously we're in extraordinary times, a state of emergency. Things are not normal at the moment. And one of the casualties of this, the state of affairs, was the Toronto Comic Con, which, as you can imagine, you know, Toronto, Canada's imperial center, you know, a seat of politics, culture, art, you know, big metropolitan hub. So you can imagine some of the heavy hitters that were going to be at Toronto Comic Con. And, you know, because this is a special, this is a podcast under special circumstances, you know, we're recording this over Zoom because we're both self-isolating or social distancing, whichever it is at the moment. In addition to our regular podcasting being interrupted, you know, the Toronto Comic Con is another casualty. And I just wanted to, in memoriam, tell you a few of the celebrities who are going to be there. I've got them in front of me with a picture. Now, I'm going to, you know, I think to make this interactive, I'm going to put to you some of these names, and you can tell me if you know, if you have any idea who the fuck these people are. I would say you get like at least half points if you can even guess the thing that they're from.
I like my odds, actually. I think, I'm well versed in this shit. Lay it on me.
All right. Big man over here. So this is the number one ranked person on the list, Brian Herring. Do you know who that is?
I do not.
So it's funny because all the other people have a picture of them. And for Brian Herring, there's just a picture of that BB-88 character from Star Wars. So I'm assuming that's him. So you could get to see BB-88. Or whatever the fuck he's called. You know, the one with the, like, looks like a soccer ball.
Yeah, I know BB-8.
Okay.
Does that count as getting it?
Excuse me, BB-8. Well, no, because I've told you. It specifies appearing Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So he was doing, like, three opportunities to see him, or perhaps one opportunity to see him thrice if you're really passionate. Kathy Najimy.
I know her.
Okay, so she's Hocus Pocus. I guess, okay, there's a few other A-listers I'm going to leave to the last minute, but there's some fun ones. Now, mind you, these are all count as A-listers in the Comic-Con world. So Craig Parker, do you know who that is?
No, I don't. So that's one for three so far.
So Craig Parker, it just says Craig Parker, Lord of the Rings. Now, the only reason I know who this is because there's a picture of him in character. He's whatever that, like, second tier elf who's at the Battle of Helm's Deep. He gets killed.
No, I never made it through any of those movies.
Wow, interesting. Anyway, so that's him. Austin St. John.
Oh God, no. I'm sorry. I came out guns a-blazing, cocky and arrogant. I don't know any of these people.
So he's in Power Rangers.
Which ranger?
I don't know. I'm going to go to his bio. Okay. Oh, and actually, wow, I'm glad I did because appearance information also appearing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Autograph price, $50. Photo op price, $60. Price is subject to change. So they can barter you up. And interestingly, at no point does it actually tell you here which Power Ranger it just says Austin St. John Power Rangers. Because I think the assumption is if you are interested in this, you would know.
Well, I mean, I think that is the point. But if you told me it's the Red Ranger or the Green Ranger,
then I would get very excited. But, you know.
Okay, so John the Snake Roberts, do you know who that is? Some kind of WWF person. And it's funny that it's WWF, it says, because this presumably means he's like a 90s one, because they changed it to WWE, right, in the late 90s, early 2000s, something like that.
You know, I once covered Comic-Con as part of, as a varsity reporter.
And right.
It was very exciting because I got to meet Mr. Ernie Hudson. And if you don't know who Ernie Hudson is.
I do not, I confess.
He was the fourth Ghostbuster. The one who was not Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, or Harold Ramis.
He's like the Pete Best of the Ghostbusters. Like, not even the... I mean, that sounds like...
Well, he's the Ringo. Give him credit.
Okay, excuse me. So I just want to do a few more of these. Tim Rose, do you know who that is?
No.
There's a picture of him. Well, not of him. It's him in character. It's another Star Wars thing. And it's like he's one of those Mon Calamari. Like, he's the same species as Admiral Ackbar. I don't think it is Admiral Ackbar. Now, there's two real heavy hitters here, and I think these are funny in their own right, because having read you all the other ones, I think it's funny to see who then passes for heavy hitters. So these are the two biggest ones. So we got Adam Baldwin, who I believe founded the Gamergate hashtag. Yeah.
I have heard of him.
He's so big dicked that he's only appearing Saturday and Sunday. No Friday appearance for him. And then last, but certainly not least, first among equals, certainly, one Mr. Breckenmeyer, who is, you know, it's interesting, all the things that they credit, like, could have credited him for, it just says Breckenmeyer Robot Chicken.
Interesting. Not Garfield, not Rat Race?
Not Road Trip, either. Now, so Breckenmeyer, I was curious about the prices here. So there's three prices listed for him. Autograph price, 60. Photo op price, 80. Then there's a third, table photo op price, 60. So I guess if you just line up to get an autograph, you can pay $60 for the autograph, or $120 to get a photo at the table. But if you want to just get a photo not at the table, to make it look like you've actually met Robot Chicken star Breckenmeyer, you can pay $80, but no autograph.
Do you think we're famous enough at this point to get a table at Toronto Comic Con?
I mean, if we're not, it's a great insult. I mean, I think a running grievance we've had is that we're not really given, we're not treated as the Toronto podcasting impresarios that we so clearly are. We never seem to make Toronto Life's like the most powerful 100 or whatever the fuck it is. And goddamn it, if like PC staffers at Queen's Park, no one's heard of, get to be on there, damn it, so should we.
Well, we're taking a step in that direction with today's bonus fan episode, where we rally Michael and Us Nation together in a community, into an army that we'll hopefully use for purposes like that later. First of all, pardon to listeners for any audio quality issues. Luke and I talked earlier, and we made the big decision that we are going to invest in new microphones.
Well, and we also talked earlier and made the decision we were going to do this over the internet, because for now, I really think it's best that we all take the proper precautions. You know, we're not going to beat you guys over the head with it. There's a lot of annoying posting going on right now. I hesitate to use the phrase, but virtue signaling, a lot of that bullshit going on. But, you know, take precautions, be safe. Before we kind of get into things, you know, I mean, these are unusual circumstances, just in that we're not in the same room, and I haven't seen you, I guess, for over a week. So, I mean, how's it going? How are you doing?
Oh man, I'm not enjoying it. I see a lot of people who are, you know, getting time off from their jobs and, you know, sitting around and watching movies all day, and I'm very envious. I'm very envious of those people, because if you work in communications in a public sector institution, now is not a restful period.
Will just gave everybody a big clue about what he does for work. So, docs, Will, that's your task for the pandemic, folks.
But being at home, I found it quite pleasant.
Yeah.
I'm not stir crazy. In fact, all of my FOMO is gone now.
Well, and you don't live alone either, which probably helps, right? Obviously, listeners, you're all in different circumstances. For my part, to fill you guys in, I mean, I basically am alone apart from, my girlfriend is visiting me, or, you know, we're spending a lot of time together. Friend of the show, Bronco Marchetich, my colleague, I've been seeing him a bit. But basically, you know, I live alone. I live in a one-bedroom apartment in downtown Toronto, and I'm just kind of slogging it here. And it's not maybe as bad for me because I do, I work from home a lot of the time anyway. Mm-hmm. I have kind of a ritual I do here, and I'm just kind of continuing that. I think the biggest thing for me is that I can't go to the gym. There's a gym in my building, but it's actually closed. And so I've been doing home body weight workouts. I did a lot of research into those. I actually just did one. And I got to tell you, I mean, it's not ideal, but I feel like 110% better. I'm also going to start when I get my, as people can hear, I'm still a bit congested. So when I get my lung capacity back from whatever this cold that is definitely not the coronavirus, my building is like over 30 floors. I'm just going to run up and down the stairs and no one uses the stairwell. So that's going to be my cardio because I got no treadmill, I got no bike, I got nothing. And I mean, I have been taking long walks at night, but there's kind of limits to that. I mean, I also don't, I think like if we're going to kind of stay indoors, it's good to like embrace that principle as much as possible. So I'm kind of doing that.
I've also, I've actually not been exercising. I've been eating very poorly. So I've been embracing the indoor lifestyle, I think, more than you.
Tell you what, if we get the Patreon, we're at whatever, 635 right now. If you guys get it back up to 6, I mean, I don't know how generous do you want to be here. If you guys get it up to 675, which would be a new record, I will post my home workout video that I made on the, it's actually just about a 15 second clip on the Patreon. We're a week into the pandemic and you know, we're already selling out, you know, finding new ways to commodify the situation.
It's weird to feel myself rooting against getting more Patreon subscribers, and yet here we are.
It looked better than I thought. It's funny. I put a chin-up bar, like, you know, those chin-up bars where you can like screw it onto the door, and it kind of fucked up the door frame, but it does actually work as a chin-up bar. I'm just going to like have to live with a fucked up door frame because these are extraordinary times. So I was doing chin-ups and hanging leg raises, like where you hang from it and then you just like raise your legs into like a V shape. It actually worked. And obviously you can't work out, you know, shirtless when you're at the gym, but you can when you're at home. So my girlfriend made a little clip of it. It looked better than I expected. So maybe during the pandemic, I'll become one of those Instagram, you know, fitness influencers. Like, let's see how much I can expand the, you know, the brand during this. By the way, I'm only saying all this because it's behind a fucking paywall.
And I'm obviously
joking.
Perhaps transition the brand into a new kind of brand.
I mean, you know, it would be funny if we just like rebranded the podcast to be ultra normie during these times. Well, I feel like the times may actually call for the exact opposite. So we'll see how things evolve, and we'll see if like a week from now you and I are still of the same nonchalance where we're just like, oh yeah, staying indoors, working out, reading. I've been doing a lot of that. I started watching, I don't know if you've seen it, but the 7-hour Soviet production of War and Peace from the late 60s.
Have not seen, actually.
I mean, it's like, I bought it, and of course, you know, it's I won't say it's a slog because it's really good, but it's like sitting down to watch a 7-hour movie is pretty daunting. So I watched about 3 hours of it the other night. It's kind of separated into like four parts. And I watched the longest part, which was part one, and a little bit of part two. But yeah, it's like right now I'm kind of enjoying that sort of thing. And the only thing is I feel a bit of cabin fever. Anyways, we'll update everybody in a week, and we'll see if we're still of this same attitude. But I guess I'll just reiterate something I said on the intro, I guess, to that current affairs crossover we did, which, by the way, I hope people enjoyed that. It's the kind of thing we want to do more of. But, you know, we hope, we send you all our best wishes. We hope you're doing okay wherever you are in the world, whether you live by yourself, whether you live with other people. These are very strange times we're living in. It kind of crept up on us pretty quickly. But Will and I, we're going to be podcasting through this, probably doing, you know, some more content like this. We were kind of planning to do this episode anyway, but more content that's maybe of a bit the looser variety, shall we say, just kind of hanging out and, I guess shooting the shit and giving you guys some extra content while also, of course, maintaining the regular quality Michael and us content that's made us podcasting impresarios here in Toronto and indeed
We have a brimming mailbag here, and I guess we'll start at the beginning with a question from Doodles Inc. I don't know if that is the gentleman's real name.
Is that a person or an institution? Anyway, that's how the LLC known as Doodles wants to be identified, and we're going to respect that.
He says, "Hey guys, I really like the podcast. It was even the first Patreon I subscribed to. This question doesn't have anything to do with politics, but something more lighthearted. What was any piece of media, a song, book, movie, etc., that as an adult you turned red in embarrassment? And is there a part of you that can still somewhat enjoy, not even on an ironic level, just straight, I like this sort of thing? I don't like the term guilty pleasures." Well, I sort of feel like the podcast was built with the bricks of things that make us turn red with embarrassment now.
Yeah, I mean, I there's definitely some sort of early 2000s books that it's funny. It's a good question for today because I was missing something in my apartment. I was kind of looking through drawers and I remembered that I have this drawer where I put a bunch of books that I'm just kind of storing because I'm not going to read them. And they're just kind of like, some of them are a bit embarrassing. And one of them is this book by Christopher Hitchens called A Long Short War, I think. Mm-hmm. It's not one of his better known books. The subheading is called The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. And has a picture of the famous kind of toppling of the Saddam Hussein statue in that square, I guess, in Baghdad. And this was the kind of book, along with Michael Ignatieff wrote a bunch of kind of politics-related books. These were the kinds of things that when I was a teenager, and even kind of some extent in my early 20s, I would pick up and I would read sometimes at college book sales, or I would get them secondhand stores when I was a teenager in Stratford or Hamilton. I guess I turned red with embarrassment in the sense that I didn't really have the tools to even understand what these were or how to situate them. And now that I do, just the idea that I would ever even have spent like $2 or $3 on a book like this is pretty embarrassing. And the same goes for like the new atheist books we've talked about, where I genuinely did think these are really smart books. And now I would not display like a Richard Dawkins book on my shelf. I don't know. How about you?
Yeah, there was a period, particularly when I was in first and second year university, when the idea of reading anything vaguely political, you know, just being very intellectually omnivorous and trying to create an identity for yourself leads to, I mean, I just moved recently and threw out a lot of Christopher Hitchens books that I used to have, including I used to have a book that was the transcript of his Monk debate with Tony Blair.
Oh God, which friend of the show and I think three-time guest Alex Ross actually attended as a varsity reporter, right?
Oh, wow. God, yeah. I wish I could take a midnight in Paris limo back to that.
So there's also some suggestions here for future episodes. So I think we'll just say at the start of the podcast, we do read all these suggestions, but if we read them ourselves and we thank you all for them, but if we read them all out as part of this, it's going to take too long. So we'll just leave that for now, but thank you for the suggestions. I guess I'll just preemptively make the slight exception that if a question involves a suggestion, we might read it. But anyway, don't take offense. We are reading all these. So Darcy Gibbons asks, "Hey guys, my young Zoomer son wants to be a YouTuber. As scholars of the medium and content creators yourself, what advice do you have for those just starting out?" Just kidding. I'm not letting him upload anything, but it's still a good question.
Be a cool person with a good personality and things to say.
I'm not sure what I would say. I would like to have a funny answer to this, and I can't really think of one. I guess Will's kind of nailed it. I mean, it's like just don't be a YouTuber, a podcaster, a creator, whatever. It's a word I kind of hate, but it's like, don't do that for its own sake. Like, have something to say. There's definitely a surplus of content on the internet. There could be less of it, and there could be more stuff that's better. So I guess that's what I would say to that. And I'm just gonna, Darcy Gibbons actually asked a second question. So I wanted to get to that. Is that Garfield restaurant still around? I think of it every few months and get unreasonably angry. You would know better than me.
Yeah, well, there is a Garfield-themed restaurant in Toronto called Garfield Eats, where they sell pizzas that are shaped like Garfield's head. It doesn't quite work, but I know they're around because they just a day or two ago sent out a problematic tweet. It was like a picture of Garfield as a superhero and a caption along the lines of, cats don't get coronavirus or something like that.
Oh my God.
The Garfield restaurant was dragged on Twitter for that.
yeah, let's, everybody should go to the Garfield restaurant's Facebook page and register your outrage at that. Let's cancel the Garfield restaurant.
There's a question here from Michael Quincy O'Neill who says, "Dear Luke and Will, what are your thoughts on Michael Moore's podcast, Rumble? Furthermore, has present era Michael Moore redeemed himself in your eyes?" Well, Michael, I'm glad you asked that because I am a big fan of Michael Moore's podcast, Rumble. I've listened to many episodes. I find that I agree with Michael Moore 70, perhaps even 75% of the time. About 75% of the time, he's absolutely on point on the podcast, but there's still that 25% of like boomer brain that just keeps getting in there. He keeps saying things like, "Well, you know, we all have to unite around whoever the nominee is. You can say something good about any of those people on that debate stage. You know, things like that." He had an interview with Ralph Nader that I listened to with great interest, where it was happening during the impeachment, and Nader said something vaguely critical of Pelosi's leadership, and Michael Moore was really excited about the job she was doing. And he said something like, "Oh, but that's the old Nancy. This is the new Nancy right now."
Yeah, so, I mean, I hate that. That's awful.
He keeps saying things like that. I think Michael Moore, he's still the furthest left voice who gets to be on TV. So for that, I think he's owed a debt of gratitude. And I also think I have some sympathy for Michael Moore, too, as somebody who has spent a lifetime sort of stumbling in the dark, trying to find a way to make these ideas popular and palatable to people.
I think Michael Moore gets a lot of credit for unapologetically supporting Bernie Sanders twice. I definitely think there's something to that. What was the second part of that question? It was like,
has he redeemed himself in our eyes?
I guess you've kind of answered that. I think I would agree with you on that. There are certain gestures he still wants to make towards, you know, the Democratic center or whatever that I'm really not in sympathy with. And I do think, you know, if people revisit the episode, which I think is one of our most popular episodes, where we watched his kind of stand-up show special that he did right before the 2016 election, that's an example of him leaning into, I think, some of his worst, you know, instincts.
I listened to the episode he did with your colleague Alex Press, and I found it a very interesting episode because, I mean, he did a lot of talking in it. She kind of didn't get a word in edgewise, but he seemed very excited and very liberated by how blunt she was, how sort of unapologetically left-wing she was. I find the episodes where he talks to people who are younger than him and maybe to his left very, very interesting because it seems to blow his mind that you can talk that way.
So another question here. This is from John in Boston. Will you ever consider doing your podcast on video as well, like Useful Idiots? So I'm a big Useful Idiots fan, although I mostly just listen to it on my podcast app. I do sometimes watch the clips on YouTube. But actually, right before we started recording, that was something Will and I discussed. So we may actually do that, during this pandemic. We may do that, and you guys will get to see us talk on Google Hangouts for anybody that gives a shit about that.
Wow. So you can delete, you know, Pornhub and X-Hamster and all your other bookmarks because some hot, spicy content is coming your way. Here's a letter from Jessen Fox who says, "Hey, all, this is your dear friend and loyal listener, Jessen, the union organizer in California. As a podcast that both covers socialism and film, I would love to hear some history about the Hollywood blacklist during the McCarthy era. What did it mean to be blacklisted, really? Were the people blacklisted ever actually working for the Soviets? Who did the blacklisting? And how did actors getting blacklisted impact the film industry at the time? Were there prominent Hollywood snitches? was Will's personal hero and icon, Clint Eastwood, turning in commies left and right, like I imagine he was? And lastly, are there any documentaries, books, or articles you would highly recommend about this time? Appreciate all you do. Well, listen, Clint is a libertarian, so he thinks that your politics are your own business. I'm sure that would have extended
to communists during the McCarthy era.
There were certainly prominent snitches, Ilya Kazan, the most prominent of them all. But yeah, I definitely think this is a ripe topic. You know, something that we should maybe watch is On the Waterfront.
Oh, I'd love to, which is actually a great film directed by Ilya Kazan, but which is sort of him trying to excuse himself for snitching, but is nevertheless one of the great American films.
Yeah. A question from Dan Kapur, longtime fan of the podcast. Recently, I was talking with a friend of mine about my hatred for the Disney Corporation and my personal disgust for what they've done to movies. I was a big fan of Will's hatred for Baby Yoda. I should mention that I'm a stand-up comic based in Baltimore. One thing I've learned is that nothing will make an audience turn against you more quickly than doing a joke about killing Baby Yoda. I'm not exaggerating here at all. All I said was, if you could go back in time, would you kill Baby Yoda? And I've literally never had a good set come to such a screeching halt, complete with jeers from the audience. Even the comics doing super racist material don't get that reaction. Anyway, I was recently talking to a friend of mine, a comic who lives in Los Angeles, about Disney and Marvel. We had a disagreement that surprised me, and she specifically connected it to white socialist movie criticism, so I wanted to hear your thoughts on it. For context, I am white and she is South Asian. She was talking about how much she hated Martin Scorsese's recent comments that the Marvel movies aren't real cinema. I said I pretty much agreed with him. I've always felt that MCU movies are more like rides and less like movies, although I thought the villain story in Black Panther was interesting. My friend suggested I only agree with Scorsese because I'm a white man, and she talked about how much that representation on screen has meant to her and so many other people of color, how it's given them something like that up till now only white people have had, et cetera. I'm going to abbreviate the email because it's a long one, but I'll go towards the end here. My friend identifies herself as a Marxist, but she finally suggested that a big problem with white socialist movie critics is that they focus so much on economic issues, but don't give enough weight to racial ones. I was wondering what you think about this as white socialist movie critics and whether you've encountered this criticism before. I think this is an interesting question. It seems that the debate you had parallels debates that I myself have had in my personal life, including debates I've had with people quite close to me. I would say that one of the problems maybe of those two things being two paradigms, one of the problems is it suggests that one is good and one is bad. But there is more to cinema than just Martin Scorsese and what he represents. So I guess I am sympathetic to those who would say that widely debated Scorsese versus MCU debate is reductive to the great art of cinema.
I would just weigh in on this to say, I think my big issue here is, I mean, obviously it's unabashedly, if that's the right word, a good thing. It is undeniably a good thing that mass culture has become more, you know, more diverse, that it has better representation than it used to have. My issue here, I mean, the sort of conservative culture warriors look at this and they say, this is bad, this is liberal social engineering or whatever. And of course, that's absolutely absurd, right? But just because something irritates conservatives, and conservative culture warriors are people whose politics are deeply shallow. It has to do with aesthetics and personal resentment and, you know, just kind of cultural signifiers. Just because something annoys them doesn't mean that it's, you know, a particularly positive or constructive political project in and of itself. My problem with the sort of liberal culture warriors, as it were, who would treat a movie like Black Panther as if it's some great triumph, is that it's not. I mean, it's not that it's a bad thing as such, but it is not a great political victory. It is private enterprise making a decision to, which, you know, in many ways is a self-interested one, to be more representative, to have more diverse casts and crews and things like that, which again, I'll reiterate, is not a bad thing, but it is not the, you know, great triumph that I think politically that some people, you know, maybe think it is. And my issue here is more that those kinds of cultural victories, issues around representation, things like that, for a lot of people, that's where the horizons of politics stop. And we're living in a world where, you know, particularly now, it's so clear that we actually don't live in a post-political age, even if that is kind of the you know, where the cultural zeitgeist is at. We do now, and we've always lived in a world where politics matters a great deal. And politics doesn't just encompass, you know, one of the things neoliberalism did, I realize it's kind of a long-winded answer, but one of the things neoliberalism did, you know, is it privatized politics as we know it. I mean, think about a world before the 1980s where, you know, even the kind of, you know, even the sort of mainstream political parties, there was a lot more space between them in most, you know, most democratic countries than there is now. And when you subordinate everything to the tyranny of the market, one of the things you do is you marketize forms of resistance, you know, and forms of protest. So everything becomes a commodity. And so this is where we got, you know, ideas like we're going to fight exploitation in the underdeveloped countries by buying the right kind of coffee or whatever, right? Mm. Like our act as consumers, our most transactional relationships can actually be these like progressive or constructive political acts. And we now have, you know, 30 years or more of evidence that this doesn't work. You know, this doesn't, you're not going to cure poverty by making different consumption choices. You're not going to stop climate change by making different consumption choices. And I could go on and on about this, but by the same token, you're not going to, you know, fight racism by diversifying, you know, mass culture that is still driven by the needs and interests of large-scale private enterprise.
I also think it's important to note that something like Black Panther serves an underrepresented audience that is underrepresented because of companies like the Disney Corporation. So, I mean, I think they deserve limited kudos for
right.
22 films into a 22-film cycle.
Well, and this is another thing about neoliberalism, right, is marketizing everything creates problems, but neoliberalism will always come in and tell you that there's a market solution to the problems the market creates, right? Yeah. So fuck that. But anyway, that's a great question. And I love the bit about Dan's stand-up routine and killing Baby Yoda. Dan, if you have a clip of that, I would love to see it. and I would watch it being fully on your side, by the way. So there's another question here from Alex. Looking at the most recent primary elections, youth turnout seems to be up, but boomer turnout seems to be skyrocketing for Biden. Why are boomers coming out in droves to fuck over the kids? Did we finally find a candidate that represents the new silent majority, the dementia constituents? Well, I was hoping we'd avoid politics on this episode, but yes, my impression of the turnout is that, yes, Bernie has successfully increased youth turnout, but boomer turnout is also up. And you can look at state after state and see just how serious the kind of generational schism is. I won't answer this question. I have a lot of thoughts on this. I won't answer it in much more detail, but I would turn people to what I said at the end of the Being There episode, which I think was the last week's one, so before the current affairs crossover. I think that there is a sort of meta-political struggle going on right now between two narratives about what's needed in the present. You know, there are young people who feel overwhelmingly, and older people too, but I think to a huge degree, you know, people under the age of 40 or 45 feel that we need quite radical political progress. And then there are older people who, you know, feel that there's some kind of lost sense of normalcy that needs to be restored. And in the Democratic primaries, this is the sort of primary vehicle for this debate has been this whole notion of electability, which we don't have time to get into here. But suffice it to say, if you also look at exit polls not people's who they voted for, Biden or Bernie or anyone else, but if you look at the exit polls of what Democratic voters say about you know, Medicare for All in particular, there is some encouraging evidence that many of the older voters who are voting for Biden still support it now, or at least they support it abstractly, just not enough to vote for the person that champions it. Anyway, we'll get into this in some more detail on future episodes when we get into political events of kind of recent weeks in more detail. I'm kind of waiting for things to settle because things are in such flux. It's kind of hard to know.
A letter here from Mungo Tatton Brown. He says, "Hi, Luke and Will. Hope you're both surviving the ongoing apocalypse. One thing liberals are often accused of is elitism. But what are liberals supposed to claim when the elite just isn't that elite? Joe Biden's ascendancy seems to disprove the idea of a meritocratic Democratic Party, as does Justin Trudeau's in Canada. On the one hand is a man who did not see any harm in repeatedly wearing blackface and who thinks quoting the year is an example of a reason for a policy position. On the other is a man who speaks incoherently about record players, confuses his sister with his wife, and plagiarizes Neil Kinnock, of all people. Not exactly the bottom rung of the expanding brain meme. Would it be better if liberals actually prioritized the cleverest, most capable people? Or is this an irrelevant concern? Should we only be concerned about their values and platform? And are the Bidens and Trudeaus really as dumb as they seem?"
It's a really good question. I think that there's so many ways you could come at this. In fact, we could do a whole episode, but I guess just in brief, I mean, so I guess to start kind of from the end of this, are they as dumb as they seem? I mean, yes, I think they are. I mean, I think one of the revelations, I mean, you could have this revelation at any time, but I think 2016 in particular was very, it was a good moment for it. One of the revelations that came out of the Hillary Clinton campaign, right, which I think more than any other in recent memory kind of embraced all these, you know, great liberal kind of shibboleths about meritocracy, and we're going to have the smart people running things, and we're going to make campaign decisions based on an algorithm, and it's okay because we have the focus groups and the smart people and the pollsters told us, blah, blah, blah. And they lost to the guy from The Apprentice, right? Mm-hmm. And that should give you a clue about what meritocracy is actually about in the real world, because obviously the ethical principle of meritocracy is one that makes a certain degree of intuitive sense, or, you know, it's also often called like equality of opportunity or something like that, right? Just the idea that people have different talents and abilities, and there should be some system of desert in some parts of society that is proportionate to what people contribute or whatever. Or if you like, stated another way, people that are born into a lower social station, a lower class position, if they're sufficiently talented through social mobility or whatever, their talents should be able to carry them out of it. That's the official idea of meritocracy. But look at what meritocracy means in practice in the sort of liberal political ecosystem, right? Look at a friend of the show, Pete Buttigieg, and the effusive praise that he got for being quote unquote smart, right? And what did his intelligence consist of, right? It was just like, oh, well, campaign aides say that he ducked into a car and he started speaking French so that no one else would understand like what he and his other aide were saying. Or he said a sentence of Norwegian, or he read Ulysses one time or something like that. And you start to see pretty quickly, this is actually about particular signifiers of education and like these are class signifiers. They're not actually about people's particular talent or ability to reason or whatever. It's all a pretty shallow mess. Mungo, if you have follow-up to that, or if there's anything I kind of didn't capture, I think I have more to say to that. So feel free to post on the Patreon if there's anything else we can add to that.
Gareth Lyons asks, "I don't remember you ever mentioning the David Brent movie, despite talking about The Office a lot, and I wanted to know your thoughts. Forgive me if it was mentioned on another pod. Did you see the David Brent movie?"
I have not seen it. Life on the Road, it's called, right? Okay. I mean, Gareth is right that this is an ideal candidate for our podcast. I think it's one of those things where there's, you know, a constant tension on our little show about what are we actually willing to subject ourselves to from week to week. And I think this one might be a bit of a slog. I watched the trailer when it came out, and it looks kind of like, you know, Office fan fiction. So I'm a little worried about it, but it is a great candidate. And as for those suggestions, definitely Parks and Rec, the thick of it. I'm a little, I don't know about Iannucci's Turn to the Dark Side with Jess Phillips, but let me say that for me, the words Iannucci's Turn to the Dark Side with Jess Phillips is kind of whatever the opposite of cellar door is in terms of being an ominous and ugly phrase. So I look forward not to finding out what that is.
I should say that I did see David Brent, Life on the Road. I don't remember it very well, but I remember it being very poor. And an example of how poor it is as the movie begins, David Brent is working at, I think he's a salesman for like a tampon company. I think it's a tampon company, which I think sums up what was lost in Ricky Gervais's artistry. When you compare that to a paper merchant from the original show, which is just a perfect, you know, poetically banal place to work.
Well, and also I think that one of the key things about Wernham Hogg at, you know, in the paper merchant that he works at, is that it's a dying industry, right? I mean, it's like they're working, it's middle everything, but also it's sort of like middle late stage capitalism as well, because it's like, it's, I mean, what does Wernham Hogg do, right? The business model, as far as one can discern, is that it buys paper from big suppliers and then it sells it to people at a markup, basically, which, like, first of all, in a world where everything's moving towards computers, right, there's a less of a demand for paper. But secondly, as a business model, it doesn't really make sense. And things like Office Depot, right? Like, you can just go and buy bulk now. The business model is as much an anachronism, you know, as David Brent's music tastes.
Alta Rachma asks, "Dear Will and Luke, as a young casual film fan for most of my life, most of my encounters with film criticism came through YouTube and the IMDb review section. I took very seriously the movie reviewers of YouTube and IMDb because they seemed really sophisticated to my teenage ears. Now I mostly follow Will, and a few other blogs. I wanted to ask what you thought of the online YouTube/IMDb movie criticism landscape, and what are some of its merits, if they exist? Also, if you could recommend reading or following any particular movie critics, especially those with a Marxist disposition, I would greatly appreciate it."
Buddy, we can sure help you there.
Obviously, there's been a huge explosion of film criticism on YouTube, and it's crazy to imagine that probably more people have seen and are influenced by somebody like the Nostalgia Critic than have been by Pauline Kael
or Cool Duder.
Like how many people have watched a Cool Duder video versus how many people have read a Pauline Kael book collection in the last 10 years? I mean, that's a mind-blowing thought. And you can see that they all have disciples online. All these guys have influenced so many people. But I mean, putting those aside, obviously YouTube has, and you know, Twitter and blogs have created a great landscape for all sorts of different approaches to film, whether it's queer or feminist or through a racial lens or through a political lens. When I'm looking for critics, I don't consciously look for who's a Marxist critic. I find it somewhat limiting if people are looking at something strictly through a political rubric. But oftentimes I think, you know, my favorite critics are people who have a coherent politics that maybe sort of subconsciously informs everything they write about. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I would say to the second part of this question, Will and I have, you know, known each other for a long time now, and we've introduced each other to various things. And, you know, some of the things I'm most grateful to Will for introducing me to are various film critics. So, I mean, I was familiar with Roger Ebert, but I didn't know that he has these books, The Great Movies. And they're a great place to start, not from the point of view of sophisticated film criticism. We should, by the way, do a whole Roger Ebert episode, shouldn't we? But they are good from the point of view of, you know, what Ebert is good for is, you know, he's an appreciator of cinema. I have all four volumes of The Great Movies. You can get any one of them. And they are a great starting point, much better than like the IMDb Top 250 or Empire 500 or whatever. In terms of almost any film in there is going to be historically and culturally significant at minimum. And in most cases, they're also going to be important films that you're going to enjoy and are going to become special to you. Mm-hmm. But I would also say, I remember when I bought the first Ebert volume and I asked Will, who else can I read? And you said something like, well, you know, in addition to this, you definitely deserve like a higher level film critic, because Ebert is a normie appreciator of cinema. And it is good to have people, particularly for obvious reasons, I'm partial to socialist and Marxist criticism. And Will, I'm surprised that you didn't bring up, I mean, two of the people you recommended to me are both of that persuasion and are very good.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of Jay Hoberman, former critic of The Village Voice. if you can find his book, Vulgar Modernism, it's well worth looking into. It has
what is his anthology of post 9/11 film reviews? What's that called?
Called Film After Film, which is terrific. And he has a new one out that I just read called Make My Day, about film during the Reagan era, which is well worth reading.
Film After Film, for listeners of this show, I mean, I'm surprised that it hasn't come up before. We'd actually very much like to have Mr. Hoberman on the podcast, because Film After Film is a perfect Michael and Us book. And by this, I don't mean it is like a book like Stupid White Men that we'd read and be like, get a load of this. It is a series of articles, essays that he wrote, mostly about kind of the cinema of the early 2000s that were published in the Village Voice. And he has a remarkable style. He is a leftist writer. I believe the book was put out by Verso, but you know, he's somebody who very much has his finger on the pulse of mass culture and is deeply cognizant of how kind of ideology makes its way into kind of mass culture and functions within it. So if Michael and Us listeners want anything that's fun and interesting to read that covers a lot of the same terrain that we've touched on in this podcast, you know, during the next few weeks, especially, Film After Film by Jay Hoberman, fantastic book.
I should also mention Robin Wood, the great Marxist film scholar who worked at York University here in Toronto. His signature book is Hollywood from Vietnam to Reagan, which is also well worth reading for Marxist film criticism. There's a letter from Charles Durrell who says, before I jump into my precious fan question, I just wanted to say thanks for the phenomenal content that you two put out. Aw. My good friend Rory and I look forward to your episodes weekly. You're both citizens of Australia, but we think our citizenship of Michael and Us Nation is our most valued. Well, unfortunately, that won't get you across the border, but we appreciate it.
It's all right. Michael and Us Nation is a truly cosmopolitan identity, and I'm glad that our Aussie fans agree with that too. So hello to Charles and Rory. Thanks so much for listening.
My long question is to do with the viability of electoralism in building a successful international left-wing movement. Specifically, I question the left's pursuit of success through electoral cycles. When I look at Bernie Sanders' campaign, I see a pitch for healthcare and education that is worth fighting for. I know, as living in Australia, I have benefited from a relatively adequate public system. When I imagine a successful Sanders presidency, I see a high participation democracy with a substantive welfare system, something that looks more like what we have in Australia, something comparable to most EU nations, or even what you have in Canada. However, in those countries, such improved material conditions have not functioned as a catalyst for a more radical social democracy. Instead, channeling working class power into electoral parties has weakened left-wing movements and alienated agitation outside of lobbying and elections. For example, in Australia, it was the Labour Party that ushered in an era of neoliberal reforms, weakened structures of working class power. With this in mind, and given recent electoral defeats in the UK and the early Democratic primaries, is it time for the left to channel their efforts into something more than electoralism? Should Sanders fail as Corbyn did, what do alternative paths to gaining power for the working class look like? I suppose I'm asking, is dual power possible today? Well, this is a question that I think is preoccupying a lot of people. I'm sure you have strong thoughts about this.
Yeah, so I mean, the question is, I mean, the spirit of the question is well taken. I mean, the whole kind of electoralism versus non-electoralism thing. I mean, this might feel like a bit of a cop out as an answer, but I don't really accept that as a dichotomy. I mean, particularly when you look at what Sanders and Corbyn are mentioned here, you know. They were both working to build extra parliamentary power, and in fact, both in various degrees have succeeded in doing exactly that. And they didn't do that through kind of participating in only in kind of non-electoral pursuits. Although, of course, both of them have been involved in those as well. Personally, I think when people use electoralism in the pejorative, what they mean is overly professionalized political parties that are kind of, don't have any kind of deep-seated social base apart from maybe voters that kind of transactionally vote for them in every election. Clearly, that is not a route to any kind of, necessary structural transformation of society along the lines of someone like me would advocate. And of course, what happens in the electoral sphere, which, I mean, I think an implicit kind of subtext of this question is that, what happens in the kind of electoral sphere, the sphere of the state is kind of by definition, sort of more conservative than what happens in the kind of non-electoral sphere, civil society, worker agitation, things like that. But I think it's important to remember the two are kind of symbiotic. So Charles here brings up, the example of in Australia, it was the Labour Party, that ushered in, neoliberal reforms. That was true, I believe, in New Zealand as well. In Great Britain, which I'm more familiar with, I mean, it was the Labour Party there as well that helped consolidate the Thatcherite supremacy, and in fact, I think in many ways deepen it by making it a sort of bipartisan endeavor. You could say the same thing about Bill Clinton and the Atari Democrats in the United States. But remember, these two things are kind of they're symbiotic. So part of that was kind of center politicians in center left parties capitulating to both to the conservative parties they're competing against, but also to kind of shifting and evolving material and political conditions in their societies. So by the time Margaret Thatcher left office in the UK, union density was much lower. The working class was much less powerful than it had been when the last Labour government under Jim Callaghan left office in 1979. These kind of, as it were, extra parliamentary developments profoundly shifted things in the parliamentary sphere. And that can happen in a positive way too. So for example, we did our episode, also Britain related, right, about the Harold Wilson, Edward Heath duel, whatever that documentary was called, Heath Wilson, the 10-year duel. And one of the things I noted there was that Harold Wilson, right, was not a radical. I mean, he was a socialist, a working class, guy from Yorkshire, I believe. But he wasn't, his instincts were not always particularly radical. But the center of gravity, because the British working class was so much stronger at the time, meant that the kind of sphere that, within the electoral sphere, the kind of range of motion for even the center of the Labour Party was much kind of more radical than it is today. And even the Conservative Party had to bend to kind of the tenets of that consensus. So it's not that electoral politics, particularly through the over-professionalized political parties that often exist in many countries today, it's not that those kind of alone can be a a vehicle for change. But we can use kind of formal electoral politics as a huge mobilizing tool, and we can also use them to win state power, which is one of the ultimate goals here. And I don't think that can be discounted, and these any kind of left failures in the electoral sphere should not be regarded as kind of fatal. We've failed before, and we've come back and won again. At the start of the 20th century, socialist parties in most countries were nowhere, and look at the mid-century, how different things were. So I was hoping we wouldn't get into politics too much in this one, but I was able to answer that without really getting into too many specifics about what's going on right now, and I'm going to try to keep it that way.
Well, I think that's a great note to end it on for now. We got a lot of questions. The big hat where I've got all these letters, it's still brimming full. The letters are overflowing on the ground. I'm drowning in them, basically. Folks, if we didn't get your letter, that's because we're going to do part two very soon. Luke and I are going to reconvene, and we're going to address every goddamn question in here.
Yeah, and I prefer, if we're going to do this, to answer the questions in some detail. So, I hope that's something all of you enjoy. But for now, I'll just say we really do appreciate all these great questions, and kind of to hear, we love hearing about where you're writing us from and kind of what your relationship to the show is. It definitely means a lot to us to know that the show means something to you. So I definitely had a lot of fun doing this. Will and I are going to reconvene tomorrow, and we're going to get part two of this nailed down. So for now, it's